I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance, Thursday, March 9, 2006. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland?
Here.
Cornish? Ellison? Hillstrom? Johnson? Meslow? Murphy? Nelson? Newman?
Here.
Paymar? Soderstrom?
We'll hold up on the consideration of the minutes until we obtain a quorum, but let's move along with our agenda. We will proceed today until approximately 11, even though we previously said 11:15, so that we can recess and proceed to other business. We'll reconvene in which room? This afternoon at 4:30 in room 200, State Office Building. So for right now, let's move along then to the report by the Office of the Legislative Officer, Auditor, excuse me, on chemical dependency treatments. Who do we have today?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor, and with me is Joel Alter. He is the manager of our evaluation. We also have Valerie Bombeck in the audience, who is a member of the evaluation team, and she will join Mr. Alter after I make just a very few opening remarks. I mostly, Mr. Chairman, want to thank you for this opportunity to talk about our report. I am in the somewhat awkward position of having yesterday released a report on liquor regulation, which according to the media puts me as an advocate for finding ways we can achieve lower prices for alcohol. Be that as it may, I'm here to talk about the other side of the coin, which is substance abuse. And unfortunately, we see this problem around us every day. Substance abuse does cause great debilitation of individuals, breaks up families, and often is associated with criminal activity. And on February the 22nd, we did release a report that evaluated the state's efforts to mitigate that harm through treatment both in prisons and in communities. I would like to just emphasize, Mr. Chairman and members, what I think is the central theme of that report, which is the state ought not to just fund treatment, it ought to find and fund treatment that works. That is the great challenge, but that is the challenge that I think ought to unite both supporters and critics of treatment. Treatment is often talked about in generalities, and people ask, does treatment work or does treatment not work? Well, what we know is that some treatment works with some people sometimes. And so, again, I think our challenge is to find treatment that works and make it available to the people that need it. That way we know public dollars are not going to be wasted, they're going to be used effectively, and people who need services will get the services they need. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to turn to Mr. Alter to make about a 15-minute presentation of our report. And I'd like to have Ms. Bombeck join him. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. And before we proceed with that, Mr. Alter, the chair notes the presence of a quorum, so we will suspend your testimony briefly, and let's go to the minutes of the March 8, 2006 meeting. Chair would note that there is a typo on the front page testimony from DPS on the first name of the individual who testified, so that will be corrected. Any other additional questions or corrections? Is there a motion on the minutes? Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes. Discussion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Mr. Alter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I am Joel Alter with the Legislative Auditor's Office. And as Mr. Noble said, we looked at both community-based and prison-based treatment. I'm going to start with just a brief kind of overview of those systems, and then we'll walk through our findings and recommendations. State agencies and counties play key roles in Minnesota's substance abuse treatment services. And under Minnesota law, the Department of Human Services has primary responsibility for overseeing community-based substance abuse services. For example, DHS licenses nearly 300 private and public programs that provide treatment. These programs serve many criminal offenders who are directed to community-based treatment by the courts or by probation officers. Those programs also serve many non-offenders who enter treatment at their own initiative. Counties contract with the treatment providers Also, counties and tribes serve as what we call gatekeepers for the publicly funded treatment system. By that, we mean that they conduct the assessments and make referrals of persons to programs. Meanwhile, the Department of Corrections is the lead agency for Minnesota's prison-based treatment program. DOC, when an inmate comes into prison, conducts an assessment of that person, directs them to treatment if appropriate. Then when inmates are getting ready to leave prison, DOC would work with the counties jointly to develop plans for services that the offenders need after prison. A few words about funding. Community-based treatment serves a mix of people. Some are funded out of pocket or by private insurance, but more than half of the people in community-based treatment are funded by public dollars. The largest source of public funding is something called the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, and this fund aggregates state and federal dollars for treatment. In addition, counties are expected to pay for a share of treatment paid for from this fund. But overall, the state kicks in more than $60 million a year, and that outnumbers the county's cost by more than 3-1. State funding for prison-based treatment amounts to more than $3 million a year, and nearly all of the prison-based costs are borne by the state. I should mention that there is no separate funding when offenders come out of prison. DOC doesn't receive any separate funding for those offenders, but if their incomes are low enough, they would qualify for the consolidated fund I talked about a minute ago. State law contains policies that support the use of treatment in both community and prison settings. The law contains a general policy statement that the interests of society are best served by treating chemically dependent persons. And consistent with that policy, state law also requires the implementation of rehabilitative programs in prisons for inmates. I'm going to turn next to a few slides to talk about community-based treatment and our main findings in this area. We found that the use of publicly funded treatment by low-income persons varies considerably around the state. And we looked at a variety of measures. We did comparisons with a lot of different counties. I'm going to oversimplify a bit today by giving you a couple of examples of a couple of measures we looked at. And I picked out a couple of counties, two large counties, Dakota and Anoka. They're similar in many ways, including population. They aren't the extremes among the states that we looked at, but I think that they are two populations that, where there's no particular reason to think that their low-income populations differ greatly. Well, first we're going to look at admissions per 1,000 persons in poverty, and this is the adult population we're talking about here. The graph shows that Anoka County had much higher placement rates into publicly funded treatment than Dakota, even after taking into account the size of these counties' low-income populations. Or to look at the types of treatment that offenders went into, another chart that shows that whereas a moment ago we saw that Anoka has many more admissions, in this chart we see that Dakota is much more likely to make referrals to outpatient treatment than Anoka. More than 80% of Dakota's clients entering treatment in 2003 and 2004 had an outpatient referral, and typically that was the only type of treatment that they were referred to. Anoka uses outpatient a lot too, but it's also much more likely to make referrals to inpatient treatment, halfway houses, and other types of treatment. So again, these are just a couple of counties, and we could probably pick out any number of counties to draw some contrast. But the bottom line is that there's a lot of variation, and the type and amount of treatment that the clients get depends in part on where they live. Now, various factors might explain some of the variations that we found. I'm going to focus on just a couple of these. First, differences in local assessment and referral practices. We concluded that local assessment and referral practices need more oversight. And this, in our view, could help determine whether some of these variations that I've talked about might be due to inappropriate placements. State law requires the Department of Human Services to monitor local assessment practices, but DHS hasn't conducted in-depth reviews for a number of years. Meanwhile, our report raises concerns about local assessment practices. There are statewide criteria that provide general guidelines on the content of assessments, but we did find inconsistencies. There are differences in who gets assessed. There are some counties that will only assess persons who are going to be eligible for publicly funded treatment, and there are other counties that will assess a broader group of people. Counties use a variety of assessment instruments with different questions, different levels of detail, and likely yielding different outcomes. We heard concerns about the timeliness of assessments in some parts of the state. In some places, it takes up to 3 months for a client to get an assessment. And counties also vary in the thoroughness of the assessments they conduct. For example, whether they interview probation officers during the assessment process if the person is on probation. And a final issue, Minnesota's rules, which define what chemical dependency is, have had an outdated definition for about 20 years. What we mean by that is that Minnesota's definition has not been consistent with the diagnostic manual that's commonly used by the mental health profession. DHS does plan to update the definition in 2007. So uneven use of treatment in part reflects differences in the assessment and referral practices, but we think it also appears to reflect regional differences in treatment availability. And let me just offer a few observations of some contrasts, some services that are more available in Minnesota and some that are less available. Outpatient treatment appears to be available in most of Minnesota, although counties do differ in the extent to which they rely on it. Meanwhile, many parts of Minnesota lack nearby access to halfway houses or what's called extended care. Also, in a survey, local officials told us that Minnesota has plenty of so-called 12-step treatment programs for substance abusers. In contrast, Minnesota has only two programs that offer publicly funded methadone maintenance treatment for heroin users, and both of those are in Hennepin County. Most local officials were fairly satisfied with the availability of slots for treatment of alcohol abuse. In contrast, we heard a lot of concerns about the adequacy and availability of programs for methamphetamine users, with a lot of expression of desire for longer programs, programs that are more focused on criminal offenders, and in some cases just more beds in those facilities that are willing to accept those types of offenders. We heard widespread concerns about shortages of adequate treatment for dual diagnosis clients, that is, persons who have both issues with mental health and chemical dependency. And we heard a lot of concerns about the adequacy of treatment for adolescents. Earlier, I noted that Minnesota's consolidated fund is the primary source of public funding for treatment, and appropriations for this fund have grown in recent years, from $37 million in 2000 to $63 million in 2006. But I think it's also important to note that in 2003, the legislature reduced the maximum income of persons who are financially eligible to have their treatment paid for by the consolidated fund. Prior to 2003, some persons with incomes above the federal poverty level could be covered by the consolidated fund, but today that fund is restricted to people at or below the poverty level. It's hard to know the exact impact of these restrictions, but we did find that many offenders who were sentenced to probation in 2003 for felony-level chemical use or possession did not enter treatment in the community. And also we heard from local officials that those offenders who are eligible for publicly funded treatment are much more likely to enroll in treatment than those who are not eligible. Next, I'm going to turn for a moment to some comments on treatment effectiveness. And according to state rules, the goal of substance abuse treatment is to help clients change their harmful pattern of chemical use. But I think it's also important to say that the outcomes of substance abuse treatment are not easy to measure. It's very hard to know whether someone is using chemicals, especially after they've left treatment and they're subject to less supervision. Even if we know that their chemical use patterns have changed, it's very hard to know what to attribute that to, if it was due to treatment or to other factors. There have been some good, rigorous studies of substance abuse treatment over the years, done on a national level in many cases. You'll often hear people generalize and say perhaps treatment works or nothing works. And part of the message of this report, as Mr. Noble said, we encourage you to be skeptical when you hear generalizations like that. There are studies that show that, on average, a particular type of treatment has favorable impacts. But it's also true that treatment does not succeed with all clients, and there are some types of treatment that have weak track records. Also, sometimes it's the people in a program that matter more. The people who are delivering the services may matter more than the type of treatment that's offered. Chapter 2 of our report has a lot more discussion of treatment effectiveness and what the literature has shown about treatment outcomes. Generally, experts have suggested that for treatment to be effective, it has to be long enough, and it has to address the individual needs of clients. Some national experts have suggested the treatment should be at least 90 days long, even though that whole period doesn't have to be intensive treatment. We found that a lot of treatment in Minnesota does not last that long. In addition, we heard concerns from county officials who said that some Minnesota treatment providers haven't done as much as they should to tailor their programs to the needs of their clients. We also found that local agencies that place clients often have limited information on the outcomes and the quality of treatment programs. In our report, I'm not going to walk through everything our report found and commented on regarding treatment quality and treatment outcomes, but let me just highlight a few measures that we looked at for the purpose of saying that a lot of this information isn't available in as much detail to the counties as it should be. For example, we looked at the extent to which clients complete the programs they enter, the extent to which they're readmitted to treatment programs. We looked at whether or not programs meet state licensing requirements or have been judged to be adequate by other treatment staff. For the most part, program-specific information on indicators like these haven't been distributed widely to local agencies. But I should mention, none of those things is really a magic bullet that's going to tell you flat out whether a program is working or not. But we do think that local agencies could ask better questions about these programs if they had more of this information in their hands. So overall, regarding community-based treatment, we think there are some concerns that are very legitimate regarding treatment availability, the consistency of assessment and referral practices, and we have concerns about the limited information available on program outcomes. I'm just going to walk through a few of our recommendations and highlight some key things. We think the DHS should fulfill its statutory obligation and monitor local agencies' assessment and referral practices. We also think the DHS should propose a statewide strategy to next year's legislature for improving access to effective treatment and filling some of those gaps that we talked about. I'm not going to say much about this next recommendation because it probably relates more to things that the Human Services Committee would be more interested in, but we do think there's a need to look at the statutes that govern allocation of treatment dollars and the local responsibility to share in those costs. There are some issues that we raise regarding the adequacy of that formula. And in addition, we think the DHS should provide local agencies with more information, partly just about who are these programs and what are their characteristics, but also information on how they're doing. And regarding the legislature and what they should do, we have some recommendations regarding assessments. For example, when people are jailed outside of their home counties, sometimes they're not assessed in a timely manner by their home counties. We think that the statutes should specify a timeline for those assessments, and if the county where the person is jailed isn't doing the assessment in a timely manner, then we think that, the county where that person is jailed should do the assessment and bill the home county. That's the way we do it now with DWI offenders under Minnesota statutes. And also, we suggest that assessors should be required in law to talk with probation officers if they're assessing persons who are on probation. Again, that's the practice required for DWI clients under Minnesota law, and we think it should be more broadly applied. I'm going to turn next to prison-based substance abuse programs and go quickly through our findings on those. There are essentially two types of prison-based substance abuse programs. There is, on the one hand, treatment, and treatment usually lasts 6 to 12 months. It generally consists of both individual counseling and group counseling. There was some growth, not huge growth, in the amount of treatment offered in Minnesota prisons in recent years. The other type of program is what's called psychoeducational programming. It's typically very short term. There is no individual counseling involved in the education programs. It's not considered by DOC to be real treatment. And there was considerable growth in education programs and admissions to those programs in recent years, much more so than to treatment. We examined the extent to which persons released from prison in 2004 participated in various types of programs prior to their release. And we focused specifically on persons that the Department of Corrections had assessed in prison to be chemically dependent, persons that generally they would consider to be in need of treatment. We found that only 17% of the inmates who were assessed as chemically dependent completed substance abuse treatment in prison before leaving prison. Another 9% started treatment but didn't complete it. In addition, 30% of these chemically dependent inmates participated in an education program, but again, that's not considered to be treatment. And then finally, the remaining 45% of chemically dependent inmates did not participate in any type of treatment or education programs prior to the release. Now, sometimes inmates don't go into prison or don't go into programs because they don't have enough time to complete treatment prior to the release, but in other cases, inmates were not entering treatment because there wasn't room in the prison programs. In addition, not only does a small percentage of chemically dependent inmates complete treatment in prison, but relatively few enter treatment upon release. We found that less than 10% of chemically dependent inmates entered a licensed treatment program in the community within 6 months of their release from prison. Now, when offenders are released, the Department of Corrections works with the local supervising agency to come up with a release plan for that offender. And that plan sets forth the conditions of release. It may direct the local agency to provide certain services. We observed that the release plans typically gave complete discretion to the local agencies regarding post-release chemical dependency services, rather than specifying the nature of the services that particular offenders needed. Also, in a statewide survey, many probation agency directors expressed dissatisfaction with the information they got from the Department of Corrections, both the adequacy of the release plans, but also the information they got on what types of chemical dependency services those persons got while they were in prison. Finally, we looked at what happens to chemically dependent offenders after they leave prison, and specifically we examined the extent to which they had new arrests or new convictions. The report has more detail on the nature of those arrests and convictions that I'm not going to go into today, but there is more detail in the report. Among inmates who were deemed chemically dependent by the Department of Corrections, those who started a prison-based substance abuse program but quit or were terminated had the highest recidivism rates. For example, as you see in the bars on this chart, about 65% of this group had post-release arrests within 3 years of release. Moving down, the next group we looked at were what you could call an untreated group of prisoners, and they had somewhat lower recidivism rates following release. And then finally, we have the inmates who completed a substance abuse program, shown in the bottom two bars, and they had somewhat lower still rates of reoffense. For example, 56% of them were rearrested. Now, the latter group includes inmates who entered various types of programs, and so we took a closer look at the types of programs that they were going into and their recidivism rates. We found that inmates who completed the Challenge Incarceration Program, which, as many of you know, is kind of a boot camp with a chemical dependency treatment component, had the lowest recidivism rates. For example, about 4% of the inmates who went through this program were reconvicted of serious offenses within 3 years of release. Graduates of other prison-based treatment programs had somewhat higher rates of recidivism, that's shown in the middle two bars, but they also had recidivism rates that were better than the rates of the untreated offenders that we looked at in the previous slide. And then finally, the highest recidivism rates that we found were for those persons who completed short-term education programs, which again are not considered to be treatment. Now, these findings have to be interpreted with some caution. The fact that the Challenge Incarceration Program had very low recidivism rates doesn't necessarily mean that the program works. It's possible that they get more offenders who are amenable to treatment, that there's some self-selection going on there. And likewise, with the short-term education programs, the Department of Corrections pointed out that a lot of the people that are referred to those programs are people who have been probation violators, compliance problems, and so maybe there are just some issues that they are a more difficult population to deal with. Still, we think that the results shown here highlight what DOC's challenges are. For whatever reason, the Challenge Incarceration Program is doing pretty well with the people who come through that program. And the graduates of the short-term program, for whatever reason, just aren't doing as well. We offer several suggestions for improving post-release outcomes. We think that DOC does need additional treatment beds to serve those offenders deemed to be chemically dependent, and we suggest that they come back to the legislature next year with a realistic, updated estimate of their treatment bed needs. We suggest that DOC do a better job of working with local agencies on release planning. both for those people who have been through treatment in prison and for those who have not. To try to kind of keep going if there have been good things started in prison, keep those things going once they get to the outside. In addition, it's important for DOC to have strategies for improving the reentry process following prison for inmates who haven't completed real treatment, that is, those people who have quit treatment or those people who've only been through education programs while in prison. And for the legislature, obviously, eventually, DOC will be coming back to the legislature next year with perhaps some recommendations. But for the moment, we suggest the following recommendation. We think that the legislature should amend state law to require DOC to provide supervising agencies with inmates' prison records regarding chemical dependency treatment and assessments. And I should mention that there was a similar provision that the legislature passed last year regarding prison-based information for sex offenders. So in conclusion, we think that substance abuse treatment should be more available both in the community and in prisons. Our report suggests various ways that the two main agencies, DHS and the Department of Corrections, should exercise stronger leadership in overseeing substance abuse services. We think that both agencies should provide greater assurances that persons are being placed in appropriate, effective treatment. And in the case of DHS, we think that they need to do a better job of overseeing the local agencies that make key decisions regarding the expenditure of state funds. I should mention one other thing. The recommendations in the report are, there's a summary of them at the end of the report starting on page 111, and we also have responses from the two agencies at the back of the report.
Mr. Alter, thank you. Before we proceed, I want to welcome a class of high school seniors are with us today with the Capitol Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour. They are high school seniors in the advanced government class from the Academy of Holy Angels in Richfield, Minnesota. So welcome to this committee. We've just concluded receiving a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on Chemical Dependency, after which we're going to move to some bills hearing today. Are there any questions of Mr. Alter? Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alter, in your study, I mean, it seems to me that you are looking at substance abuse treatment from the position of more court-mandated DWI offenses, criminal behavior, or did you look at treatment in general? It seems so focused on criminal behavior, because I think I would imagine that there's a distinct difference between an individual who recognizes they have a chemical dependency problem and voluntarily goes into an outpatient treatment program or inpatient treatment program versus the court requiring someone through a DWI or other criminal activity to go to counseling.
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, we looked at community-based treatment in general. We focused primarily on publicly funded treatment. Now, a lot of the people who go through publicly funded treatment are offenders who are referred by the courts, but we did not look exclusively at them. As we looked at publicly funded treatment in the community, we looked at the broad group of people. There are some parts of the report that focus on an offender population. For example, as I mentioned, we looked at the extent to which persons sentenced to probation go into treatment following their sentence. But we did look more generally at community-based treatment, particularly that which is publicly funded.
And Mr. Chair, I haven't had a chance to read the report, obviously. So did you find a difference between inpatient treatment or Hazleton kind of treatment that versus outpatient treatment?
Mr. Alter.
In recidivism.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, we don't have findings on recidivism regarding different types of community-based treatment. The literature has generally shown mixed findings regarding inpatient versus outpatient. And I think the general conclusion that people in the field have come to is that there is room and a need for both, that there are certain circumstances where people need inpatient treatment because of the combination of symptoms they have or the stage that they're at in their illness. But the literature that has looked at people and where there have actually been some studies that have referred people randomly to either type of treatment have not led to a real clear conclusion that one is better than the other. We did, as I mentioned, find that there are differences among counties in their reliance upon different types of treatment. There are some counties that, for whatever reason, refer a lot more of their people to outpatient treatment, and other counties that refer a lot more of their people to inpatient treatment. And it probably is a reflection of both what's available in their general area, but also maybe the particular approach that they take to referral and assessment, and in some cases perhaps their preferences based on their own observations. There are a lot of differences among counties.
Representative, Mr. Chair. So, and then finally, the inmates that are released from our county jails as well as from our institutions of the Department of Corrections, were you able to look at sort of the reentry kinds of activities that are required of offenders in getting treatment once they are out of those institutions? You said in your testimony that those who participated in treatment in the institution had better success, but the concern I've always had is that I think we have sort of a dismal reentry programs in the state, and when offenders get out, they're going right back into the activity that they got them in trouble in the first place. Are there findings in here?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Kamar, one of the themes of the report is that we simply need to do a better job with release planning, that it's one thing to provide the treatment in the institution, and we focus more on prisons when we look at this issue. And we said that there's not enough treatment in the prisons, but there's also a failure in many cases to do enough planning for what happens with those offenders when they get out. Again, we found that many of the release plans were kind of boilerplate rather than kind of saying, where's this offender at right now? Do they need real treatment? Is this a person for whom AA might be adequate or some other type of support group? We think that if those release plans could be a little bit more client-specific and directive, that would be a step forward. And regarding jails, we didn't look at jails specifically, but I should mention that the counties differ in their programming for people who are in jails. Jail treatment programming is really a form of community-based treatment. Those programs are licensed by the Department of Human Services. There are some counties that have jail-based chemical dependency treatment and others that don't have access to that. So there's a lot of variation.
Thank you. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your testimony so far on chemical dependency treatment and substance abuse. I think it's a critical topic. What I want to ask you about is this. Did you explore the issue of the expectation that when people do get out of the institution who have chemical dependency problems, that they are going to, that the relapse is a likely possibility, and whether or not people are going to be revoked and be sent back to the institution for what would be a violation of their supervised release contract, which is use? I mean, is there an idea that when you're talking about chemically dependent people, that there is some tolerance for giving people what they need, which is treatment, rather than just revocation? Because I've had a number of constituents tell me that, you know, they had a dirty UA and they got sent back, but they didn't get sent to a class on cognitive thinking skills or chemical dependency program or closer supervision. They just were found to be in violation of their contract and back to the institution. Do you have any thoughts on that? Does the report speak to that issue?
Mr. Ault.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, interestingly, that's an issue that is one in community-based programs as well, that we've heard some concerns that sometimes when offenders are in treatment in community programs, that they're kicked out of programs for using. That there are some programs that are simply more tolerant than others, that are willing to kind of go the extra mile with people. We didn't look specifically at revocations, either for people on supervised release or probation, but that is a question, I think, of, you know, what's the appropriate response when somebody who is chemically dependent violates the terms of their supervision? You know, have we done enough to make sure that they have the treatment they need, or is it an automatic that they go back to prison?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
What can you tell us about the likelihood of relapse for chemically dependent people? I mean, is this something that we should expect, that it's so, it happens so often, and that it's something that is likely to happen? What are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Alder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, let me point you to, if everybody's got the report there, on page 80 of the report. One of the things we look at with community-based treatment is the extent to which people cycle through treatment multiple times, because it's something that you sometimes hear about. We've heard legislators have these discussions about a revolving door of treatment. I think it's good to say, first of all, that the literature has shown that there is a high rate of relapse within this population. That doesn't necessarily mean that they all go back to treatment or that they all have relapses that are crises, but many people do use after they have been through treatment. On page 80, we took a specific look at a group of people who came out of treatment in 2004. These were people who were over the age of 30, so they had 10 years of experience as adults, and we looked at what was the treatment history of these people. And I think it's important to kind of look at both ends of this chart. On the one hand, there were a lot of people who came out of treatment in 2004 that did not have much of a history of treatment in the previous 10 years. You've got 37% of these persons who had absolutely no community-based treatment in the previous 10 years, and another 22% that had one prior treatment episode. And on the other end of the continuum, you do have about, it adds up to about, I think, 20% of this population of people that had four or more prior admissions. So I think it's important to remember kind of both sides here. There is a large part of the population who go through treatment who don't kind of keep recycling through treatment. That, frankly, as you look at a chart like this, has been the norm, that most people who come out of treatment have not been through it a lot of times. But there is a segment of the population shown on this chart who do have quite a number of prior treatment experiences. And again, reflecting perhaps the nature of chemical dependency and that relapse is common, could in some, to some extent reflect the appropriateness of treatment as well.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ellison.
Could you talk about why people relapse? I mean, I think that there is we kind of operate on the assumption that people relapse because they don't want to be law-abiding, because they just don't want to follow the law, or there's some inherent moral failure of their own. Or is it really a medical issue that would vary from person to person, or is it a combination of both? Why in your experience or in your work here in the report, are people relapsing? Is it criminal behavior in nature, or is it medical issue, or is it something else?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, I'm not sure there's an easy answer to that. I think that the literature on chemical dependency shows that use of chemicals and abuse of chemicals starts with conscious decisions and choices that people make, and in a certain segment of the population becomes unconscious choices where people essentially lose control of their behaviors. But I think it's also important to say that, as I mentioned a minute ago, to some extent, the amount of relapse that happens can reflect the appropriateness of the services those people receive. I mean, if they go into a program that if we're sending people who are criminal offenders into programs that really aren't very good at dealing with criminal offenders, or that can't deal with the particular substances that they have abused, or perhaps, as we found a lot of comments on from counties we talked to, a lot of concerns that programs are not adequately equipped to deal with the mental health issues of people who are chemically dependent. If those things aren't being adequately addressed, those may contribute to relapse at a later time. So it's a combination of the nature of chemical dependency and the common rate of relapse. The choices of individuals are a factor here, but so is the adequacy of the programs themselves.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions, then we'll move along. Thank you, sir. Representative Clark, House File 1014.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask a couple people to join me right away at the district.
Representative Clark, I'll give you the option of opening and proceeding for 5 minutes and then returning this afternoon, or just standing down and coming back and beginning this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, some people can't come back this afternoon, so I'm sorry about that. Maybe what I need to do is ask the folks who are here, some have come a distance. I need to ask if you can come back this afternoon.
Okay.
Can you come back today? Okay, so we'll hear from maybe Mr. Nelson, and I believe one of my community folks cannot come, John O'Metsky. Would you come down here, please? There's just a couple people that can't come back, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask them to say a few words, and... But I'm going to start by thanking you for this hearing, first of all. I really appreciate it, and we will have more this afternoon then.
Very good.
But if I can just very briefly say to folks, what this bill is about is such a good follow-up to the testimony you just heard from the legislative auditor. We're talking here about creating a mechanism to put adequate funding into treatment, into law enforcement, dealing with chemical abuse. And it's a really substantial bill that will help do that. And we have, it's statewide in its application, but we also have in here a number of enhancements to some provisions in the law, and particularly we want to focus on, if we had enough resources, and we focused it on, for example, one very under-siege neighborhood in South Minneapolis, could we show the difference, and could we show effectiveness of treatment and law enforcement? So I'm going to ask Mr. Nelson to just say very briefly a few words, and then... it's a good balance. We'll hear briefly from one of our neighborhood folks here.
Give your name for the record and then go ahead.
Robert Nelson.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I'm very glad to be here. Well, I'm representing MARCH, Minnesota Association of Resources, Recovery, Chemical Health, and Minnesota Joined Together, two organizations that have a strong interest in both treatment and prevention. MARCH is an organization of over 1,100 members, and I think you have a handout. Talks a little bit about how widespread we are, and that there are probably treatment people in all of your home places. This is a very good bill because it's a comprehensive approach. It addresses chemical dependency from three or four different issues and also addresses it from some of the problems. The first area it addresses is prevention. All the research says that youth are very price sensitive to alcohol, much like what we've done with the user fee on tobacco. This is a very similar approach with alcohol. It raises the price of alcohol, which will limit kids' use. It also talks, Governor Pawlenty attended the model state drug laws and talked at length about what we need to do, that we need to do something about youth access to alcohol. So this is an issue that the governor is, at least youth access, the governor is on board for that. Because it creates so many tragedies in our society. It's an environmental approach that's been recommended by the AMA, the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Another positive effect is the prevention of methamphetamine use. Most of the people that get introduced to methamphetamines actually get introduced at parties in places where they're already consuming alcohol. A recent speaker that's touring the state... name's gone out of my memory right now, but said they never brought out any of the hard drugs until everybody was under the influence because the kids would have left before that. It's an important thing to remember that alcohol is really a gateway drug. Treatment is also a very important area, and all of the auditors' comments about the length of treatment, the completion of treatment are really important. The individualization of treatment, which Department of Human Services is working on, we've rewritten some of the rules. Support systems after treatment, which is especially important for those people who are leaving institutions and stuff, is really critical. Lowering the eligibility guidelines has resulted in less people getting treatment and has left a lot of females in the place of having to make a choice between having the father of their children around who might still be using or not having that person around. It's led to a lot higher costs. Public safety, another issue that costs us a lot of money, is all the issues surrounding public safety. There's lots of statistics in here. I can just tell you that when I talk to police officers as a director of a detox center, they tell me, these are patrol officers, they tell me that 70 to 80% of their calls are people under the influence. Okay? Huge, huge amount. Another thing that happens is local hospital costs, unreimbursed care. This really is a user fee. The more a person drinks, the more an individual pays on this. People who drink very little pay very little. The people who are out drinking a lot and using the services a lot pay more. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have about 5, 6, 7 minutes left. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Good morning.
I'll speak fast. I'm Jana Mechie, and I am a 22-year resident of the Phillips neighborhood in Minneapolis. I have been chair of the Federal Weed and Seed Strategy, which is a multi-jurisdictional collaborative of residents, county, city, state, and feds, along with prevention folks. We listened very clearly to Representative Ellison a couple of years ago and have worked diligently to put a team together to look at creating a safety net, which includes prevention, intervention, consequences, you know, whatever the consequences are, aftercare. Supportive housing came up as a huge issue because once folks actually come out of treatment or out of prison or out of wherever they are, they come right back to the neighborhood and get engaged in crime again. The impacts of the crime we talked about a couple of years ago, but I actually got a visual. What's coming around right now is a map of our community. You'll notice that the red dots on the map, they reflect arrests of loitering with intent to deal. And in all of the areas where you see clumps of dots, those are school bus stops. On a regular basis, our children are solicited for prostitution, solicited for drug activity, are in harm's way. So we're trying to balance both the rights of the citizens and the rights of folks that are caught up in a life of crime, create a safety net, work together, and we believe that we have the team together to create this pilot project in Phillips with the partners. And with that, I'm going to introduce Bill Ziegler from Little Earth Community to continue this dialogue.
Thank you for hearing me again. My name is Bill Ziegler. I'm the Executive Director for Little Earth of United Tribes in South Minneapolis. I will be very brief. 6 months ago, we conducted a pretty comprehensive survey within the community of Little Earth. And the one thing that's jumped out at me the most has been bothering me ever since I did the survey is a statement a 10-year-old child made. Said, I have no dreams. I have no hope. I have no future. I have no parents. You know, I think about that. I think about the failures that I'm making within a community and the failures of, I guess, of all Indian people not to tend to our children. I think about this bill that Karen is trying to put forth. And part of this bill, of course, is programming for the youth within the communities. I think investing in the front end of kids and providing intervention and activities for kids will keep them off the street. It'll prevent our kids in the community 10 years from now from becoming the drug dealers and the gangbangers and the criminals. So I guess that's all I got to say. Thank you for your time.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
members
ma'am.
Of the committee. I'm Lucy Wieland. I'm the Chief Judge of the Hennepin County District Court. Representative Clark asked me to come and speak briefly about the Phillips Safe Zone Initiative. This initiative is based on something that was attempted in the city of Minneapolis last summer. It was a safe zone initiative that was increased policing in the downtown Minneapolis area. What we learned from that were a few important things. The first was that an increased police presence caused a significant reduction in serious crime, very significant. It had less of an impact on low-level crime. The second thing we learned was that a very small number of offenders were responsible for a significant percentage of the police contacts. And there was follow-up study done on these offenders, 33 of them in particular, and the results of that were extremely interesting. 50% of these people were what we call dual diagnosis. They had major identified mental health disorders as well as chemical dependency problems. The system had spent an enormous amount of money on these individuals. They had been incarcerated for many, many long periods of time in many institutions throughout Minnesota and in other states. They received many services from the mental health system, from chemical dependency treatment. So the short story here was we realized as a criminal justice system we're spending a lot of money, but maybe we're not spending it as smart as we should be. And that is really one of the big efforts in Hennepin County right now, is to look at how we deliver some of these services, how we can be smarter about it. And I would say that one of the important parts of this legislation, I think, is the oversight and evaluation piece of it, because it does give us an opportunity to look at what we're doing in this area with this neighborhood, with these identified offenders, and do we have success? Is what we're doing resulting in reduced recidivism? So thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Lissa Jones, and I have the privilege of serving as the Executive Director at African American Family Services. During the Legislative Auditor's Report, I'm reminded of the points of congruence. For the first time in this community, we have more African Americans in prison, particularly men, than we do in our home communities. To that extent, I'm reminded that public policy in a democracy sets a great deal forward for all of us in terms of our responsibility. In 1963, in Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail, he reminds us that law and order exists for the purpose of establishing justice. And when they fail in this purpose, they become the dangerously structured dams that block the flow of social progress. For African Americans, the stigma related to being African American and chemically dependent is a double whammy. And it is up to our state government to value its citizens and to meet us in the question of the core beliefs of our legislature about the value we add in this community. By funding these kinds of bills, we put our money where our mouth is and recognize with our citizens the real nature of what happens in people's lives when they are victims in the prison of chemical dependency. I'm urging us, if we have to reach a point of, again, legislating morality as we did in the civil rights movement, I'm urging you to step forward in courage. I'm urging you to lift your voice, and I'm urging you to influence your members to do this, because unless we can pay for it, we will pay now or pay later. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. That's fine. Let's proceed and race you over to the Capitol. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Scott Gerlich. I'm the Minneapolis Police Precinct Commander of the 3rd Precinct, which is inclusive of the Phillips neighborhood, and I just want to let you know firsthand that my officers are facing these same individuals over and over, oftentimes for serious crimes, but more often for very low-level misdemeanors. These are individuals that truly are going through a revolving door of arrests, and in my opinion, these are is a situation that cannot be solved by police presence and police arrests alone. That certainly is part of the equation, but what is missing and what is really needed to have an impact in some of our communities is job programs, is treatment, is aftercare, is housing for these offenders to prevent them from coming back and hanging out on the street corners, causing a real impact on livability within the community. I'll leave it at that.
Officer, thank you. President Clark, one more.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Scott Christensen. I'm Assistant Minneapolis City Attorney. I'm here to indicate that the city supports Section 35 and 37 of this bill, which makes violation of an exclusion order a gross misdemeanor, as well as making a third trespass or loiter offense a gross misdemeanor. The reason for this need to have gross misdemeanor sanctions for this type of behavior is that in order to have effective treatment interventions, we need more than 90 days as a maximum sentence to encourage that type of intervention. Currently, the telesis program at the workhouse, if someone was to go to the workhouse and be in need of alcohol or chemical treatment intervention, they need 60 days of actual time at the workhouse. On a misdemeanor with good time, you have to have 0 days credit before you go to the workhouse to qualify for that program. Nobody has that situation. They've been in jail a few days. They cannot get the treatment at the workhouse on a misdemeanor based on the jail credit. So having a gross misdemeanor offense for this type of conduct would allow us to provide earlier and more effective treatment interventions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just really, again, appreciate this. We can come back for some of the other testimony later.
Do you want to return this afternoon?
Yeah, that would be okay. We didn't.
You can return if you have additional witnesses, if you want to wrap up, and then stand
Thank
for
you.
Questions until 4:30 this afternoon. The committee is in recess.
Thank you very much.
Committee is on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance is back in session today, March 9, 2006. We're going to pick up where we left off with Representative Clark, and you can have your testifier and yourself do so. Then we will move to two additional bills that are listed. The last bill on the calendar, HF 1087, Powell, Representative Powell, primary seatbelt offense, has been removed from the calendar by the office, so we will not be taking that up today. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have, take two more witnesses, and then we'll be done with the testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman. So I'd like to introduce Howard Epstein, and I'll let him introduce himself from DuPont County and tell you about what his credentials are. He has some written testimony, I believe, too, that is being passed out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Howard Epstein, and I work at Dakota County Public Health Department as a planner. I am here able to represent Dakota County as well as the FACTS Coalition. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you in this continued session about this important public safety and public health issue, underage drinking and excessive use of alcohol. It causes great human suffering and is very costly, which is why Dakota County has taken a strong interest in this effort. Every day in the paper, we read about a family that's been decimated by another drunk driving crash. We read about another college student who has wandered off after a night of drinking and ended up in a river, or as just reported in today's paper, falling to her death from a grain terminal. We read about high school students who die from alcohol poisoning, or we read about a drinking party that results in teens being taken advantage of by adults. What we often don't read about is the tremendous economic impact of these incidents. Families suffer economic loss, insurance companies pay for alcohol-related problems, and all of us pay more in state and local taxes to cover the growing costs of alcohol-related problems. As stated in the report from the Supreme Court Task Force released a couple of months ago, the magnitude of the problems caused by alcohol dwarfs that of all other drugs, including methamphetamine. Alcohol is by far the number one drug of choice for teens, with nearly one out of every two high school seniors drinking on a monthly basis, and one-third binge drinking every 2 weeks. As we just heard from the Legislative Auditor's report this morning, there is a tremendous need for increased treatment services for adults and teens. Because of the impact on Dakota County citizens and government services, the Dakota County Board of Commissioners has taken a strong position in support of targeted increases of excise taxes, where those increases are focused on addressing societal problems related to the use of the substance being taxed, a true health impact fee, if you will. An increase in the alcohol excise tax should also be considered a public safety impact fee, since local governments bear much of the high costs of dealing with alcohol-related problems, including costs for public safety, law enforcement, fire and emergency response, criminal justice system costs, chemical dependency treatment, detox facilities, and the social costs that result from violence and abuse. Actually, I think that we could consider this a property tax impact fee, because so many of these costs are borne by the payers of property taxes at a local level. Currently, there is a major mismatch between what alcohol use and misuse cost society and then the tax revenue that's collected. Alcohol sales currently raise about $260 million per year, far short of the $4.5 billion Minnesotans spend each year on the costs related to alcohol use. And if we look at just what the state and local governments pay, approximately 18% of the $4.5 billion, that's $800 million per year, $500 million than what is currently raised through taxes. For these reasons, the Dakota County Board of Commissioners has taken a position that there must be more parity between the costs and the revenue received. The board supports an increase in the Minnesota excise tax on alcohol by the equivalent of 10 cents per drink, provided that the revenue is targeted toward addressing a related concern, such as the cost for detoxification, the additional costs of the .08 legislation to local units of government, preventing underage drinking or chemical dependency treatment. In this particular bill, the calculation is a significant drop in the local property tax dollars that would pay for chemical dependency treatment. The provision in this bill is something I know that the county board is supportive of. The board concluded that the Dime a Drink impact fee would have a two-pronged effect. It would generate an estimated $224 million per year in additional revenue that could be used for prevention, treatment, and enforcement, and it would also reduce underage alcohol use and the social and economic costs that result from teen drinking. The board considered the issue from a number of angles and concluded that it makes sense from a policy perspective and a fiscal perspective. It also makes sense to the public. Recent surveys from the AARP and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation show that 3 out of 4 Minnesotans support a 5 to 10 cent increase in the alcohol tax to pay for prevention, treatment, and public safety costs. The public sees it as a true user fee. Those who drink more will pay more, which makes sense because, as any state trooper can verify, the people that consume more alcohol are more likely to need their services, or ambulance services, or emergency room services, or child protection services, and so on and so on. Since minors tend to have lower incomes, they are more price sensitive. Research shows that raising the price of alcohol through an increase in the excise tax is the single most effective strategy for reducing underage drinking. One study found that a 10% increase in the price of beer would reduce by 31% the number of youth who drink 6 or more beers on a single drinking occasion. For all these reasons, a number of key Minnesota organizations have come together to form the FACTS Coalition, which stands for Facing Alcohol's Cost to Society. I believe you have a fact sheet on the FACTS Coalition. The coalition is headed by Minnesota Join Together and other leading alcohol prevention groups, including MAD and the Minnesota Prevention Resource Center. Other organizations that have declared their support for increasing the alcohol excise tax include AMC, Association of Minnesota Counties, MICA, Metropolitan Intercounty Association, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the Minnesota Sheriffs Association, and the Minnesota Medical Association. The alcohol excise tax has not been increased since 1987. Clearly, it is time to fix the imbalance between the cost of alcohol use and the revenue collected from sales. It is time for a health impact fee on alcohol.
Any questions of this witness? Representative Clark.
Mr. I think, Mr. Chairman, I do have one more person here. Mr. Lathal Murphy. Lathal here. Could you just come forward? Is he here? Or is he not? I'm sorry, I don't know him. He's a city attorney who came to answer any other questions. I guess we'll just take questions then, Mr. Chair. Did this get passed out?
No.
This is the testimony from Mr. Epstein. And anybody? Oh, there you go. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to try to answer any questions. And
sure. Questions at this time, if any, from the committee? I don't see any. Do you want to summarize?
I will.
Because when you do that, then at that point, I would just remind ourselves that this bill is currently not in the possession of this committee. That when it does arrive, it would wait, just simply wait for further action. I'll let you know. And at that point, you could come back, or the committee would just simply lay it over, as it's doing with everything else, on the table for possible inclusion later on.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this committee or this bill will need to go to other committees or not, and if it does, how will you handle that in terms of your...
President Clark, would it go to health?
I'm not sure. If health impact fee, it might. I guess if we could ask the chair of that committee if he wants to see it. I don't really know.
It's only a question. I'm not going to run out and see if they want more work, but it strikes me that it's potential, so I don't know the answer.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, just I will make a little summary statement then, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Members, this bill is before you because we do have a crisis, as was talked about earlier by the legislative auditor, in the whole area of chemical dependency. We don't have the resources that are needed. We're lacking some of the tools for evaluation, and really, there's a disproportionate burden on some of our agencies, our local counties. There's not good treatment facilities, resources in our prisons, and overwhelmingly the issue of alcohol abuse and chemical dependency is just not getting the resources that it needs in the state. And so this particular bill, I really like it because it does bring to you an adequate amount of money, possibly more than adequate, to deal with three different areas: the law enforcement needs that are there, and the chemical dependency treatment needs that are there, and there's finally a pilot project that we hope will be of great use to this legislature and to the state, because we're going to try to see what happens when we really do invest
and prevention measures. It's going to be in a small community, but one that's really under siege from the issues of drug addiction and lack of resources to deal with it. Also lack of law enforcement resources. Mr. Chairman, there's several places in here where we are increasing the hands of law enforcement in terms of some repeat misdemeanors, which we've been told by our judges is needed to help make sure that some of these folks get out of that revolving door of 50 or 100 arrests and they actually get to have mandated treatment and hopefully we break that cycle. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess unless there's any other questions from the committee, I just want to say that
Murphy
I hope...
Murphy has one. Representative Murphy.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, when we get to it, I have a finance question.
Okay. Representative Clark.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's just about it. I should probably mention that the pilot program that's in here is a two-year pilot program. Otherwise, the other funding will be hopefully permanent funding that can be there for our law enforcement, for our chemical dependency. And I think especially at a time when we find that our health insurance for many of our people who need chemical dependency just doesn't cover the services that are recommended either by their physicians or by the assessing team. This will provide that once and for all. It'll be fun, comprehensive chemical dependency treatment and the aftercare that's probably very necessary for them to be successful, the people that are in these services. I would conclude with that, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to try to answer whatever
okay.
I can on finance questions. I can tell you this raises a significant amount of money. Maybe that's what Representative Murphy wants to know.
That's my question.
Representative Murphy.
It raises a significant amount of money, and how is that money going to be distributed by the chemical dependency commission or whatever it is?
Yeah.
The pilot project is getting the money for the first 2 years, but then is it going to be a per capita thing where you... the money goes back to the area where the money was raised?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark, go ahead.
My understanding is that this money is going to be going into the existing infrastructure that we have for chemical dependency services. So, for example, at the state level, it will go into the consolidated chemical dependency fund. The counties will get a share for their law enforcement. The cities will get shares for their law enforcement. All the existing agencies, the Department of Corrections, will get a share for the prisoners who need chemical dependency treatment. The statewide program in that regard, and that hopefully will create a base that's ongoing. The exact dollar distribution, which is a good question, is not in this bill yet. We are still awaiting some information. This bill came up a little bit suddenly, the opportunity to have the hearing. So we are trying to get those numbers from the Department of Corrections, from the various agencies that can tell us, the Department of Human Services and so on. So I don't have those numbers. You'll notice that they're blank numbers there, but they will go into existing infrastructure, Mr. Chair. We hope that we will have those numbers by next week if this bill is back on the agenda.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, then there may be no connection between where the money is raised and where the money is spent.
Representative
Mr. Chairman,
Clark.
Well, it's a health impact fee that's statewide, and so the I can't think of any city, county, or state that probably wouldn't be contributing. If you're asking, will some counties, cities, state, parts of the state be contributing more than they get back or less than they get back, I don't know that that's been tracked for alcohol. And I don't know that anybody does know that. I do know that our counties are so desperate for some relief from the property tax expenses they have for law enforcement that I would think they would appreciate getting it. But I don't know the exact proportions. Maybe that's... Is there anything that you would, Mr. Weber, get up? I guess it's something that we'll have to try to get more of an answer for, Representative Murphy. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I do think we have to explore that and try to get a connection and to the areas that are currently have in need of services, the ones that you mentioned, are not necessarily the ones where the most people drink or where they have the most people that need the services of the chemical dependency services. Some counties have aggressively went out and established programs, and other counties have sat back and said, we don't have a problem here.
Hmm.
And yet they might have 900 bars where people are going to be drinking. And it seems to me that we've got to refine where the money is being raised and where the money is going to be spent. Because there's got to be a direct connection if you're ever going to sell this to the drinkers.
Mr. Chair, President Murphy, you've been around this issue in this committee longer than I have, so I would like to take your good counsel on this, and maybe you could help me put together some plan for distribution here. I mean, I think what will happen is that counties that are, I think you're right, counties that are really hurting probably will be some of the first to step up to apply, but I do hope that, that those counties that have not maybe established the kinds of programs they need will take advantage of it. And the fact that the Intercounty Association is interested in this, is supportive of it, and I believe several, which other county association?
AMC.
Is supportive of this. Maybe we need to ask their specific advice, and I'd be glad to do that between now and the next hearing and see what they have to say.
Representative Murphy, anything further?
No.
Okay.
Just to add to that, I think one advantage of to having some additional funds in the system it would be to implement some of the recommendations that the auditor, legislative auditor, presented this morning. And I haven't had a chance to read the full report, but it did seem like it pointed out some of the inconsistencies. And I know working for a local county government that with some additional incentives, I think that that is something that can create a lot of change in terms internally.
If there's nothing further, then thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to be well heard, and I'll wait to hear from you, I guess, about when it arrives at the committee when you want us back.
Yes.
Thank you.
We'll advise. Is there anyone here present from Dodge County who was here on the Demmer bill? I don't see the author in the audience. If there is not, unless and until Representative Demmer reappears, we're going to move along then to House File 2953. Seed funding for drug court project, Representative Smith and Sue Dussel. I'll meet you at the table.
Committee, Representative Smith, 2953, I understand we'll be hearing that and then laying it over for further consideration as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, and I have Sue Dussel, the Minnesota State Court Administrator, here to discuss this issue, if you will.
Hey, welcome to the committee, Ms. Dussel. Would you state your name for the record and proceed?
My name is Sue Dussel. I'm the State Court Administrator. I'm representing the judicial branch. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2953. This legislation comes out of the work of the Supreme Court's Chemical Dependency Task Force, which has spent the last year examining the impact of alcohol and other drugs, the acronym we use is AOD, on the judicial system. And I want to start by giving you a kind of an overview of the task force, its findings and recommendations, and then talk about the funding request, which is included in that legislation. If I can get this to work. The task force was established last March in response to an increasing concern that persons suffering from AOD problems are representing a growing and a pervasive impact on the judicial branch. That impact, of course, is not confined to just one case type, but it literally is across the board. In criminal and juvenile and family and mental health cases, it's a big issue and it's a growing problem. But in recent years, alternative and demonstrably more effective judicial approaches for dealing with AOD dependent persons, and in particular criminal offenders, have begun to emerge both here in Minnesota and in other states. So the task force was formed and given a very broad charge to make recommendations for how the judicial branch can more effectively deal with AOD problems. The task force filed its initial report February, just last month, and it has been focusing really on adult and juvenile AOD offenders, and a final report will be filed in September, and that will focus on all case types across the board. In terms of the task force, it is a broadly representative group with 23 members from all three branches and from all levels of government. This chairman, Steve Smith, and Senator Jane Ranum from the Senate were members of the group. And on page 4 of the report, which you have in your packet, are the names of all of the members, which you may find to be of interest. Well, let me start with some of the task force's findings concerning the extent of the problem. In the area of adult offenders, we were, of course, struck, as you are, with the ever-increasing number of drug cases and drug offenders that are admitted to prison. For example, felony cases increased from about 5,000 in 1999 to nearly 8,500 in 2003. That's a 68% in 1990. Drug offenders represented 12% of prison admissions, and in 2003 they represented over 30%. In 1990, drug offenders occupied 9% of prison bed space. By 2003, that number had grown to 25%. In the area of relapse and recidivism, we learned that on a national basis, these are very high rates for AOD offenders when they're simply sent to prison. National data indicates that 30% of AOD offenders released from prison in 1998 were rearrested within 6 months. 68% were rearrested within 3 years. And 85% returned to AOD use within 1 year, and 95% within 3 years. So it's not very effective. It's difficult to say how Minnesota compares to this national data because we don't collect and maintain comprehensive data on AOD offender recidivism. But based on the collective experiences of the task force, they believe that Minnesota's experience generally aligned with these trends. Now, what about meth? Obviously, we know this problem too well. Meth cases in Minnesota accounted for 7% of drug cases in 1999, and in 2004, that figure rose to 39%. Total meth cases increased from 472 in 1999 to nearly 4,000 in 2004. According to the Department of Public Safety, annual public costs for meth have been estimated at $140 million in 2004. And meth is the only drug whose use by women equals or exceeds that of men.
Representative Tamar, did you have a question to a particular point, or can we just finish the...
Well, I had one slide. She just went to Icon Light, too, though.
Okay, why don't we just wait, and then we'll take questions at the end. You can continue, Mr. Sell.
Drugs and juveniles. The 2004 Minnesota student survey is quite telling, and we heard a little bit about that with the previous speaker. Almost 43% of ninth graders and 63% of 12th graders had used alcohol in the past year. 16% of ninth grade boys and 15% of the girls admitted to binge drinking. 35% of 12th grade males and 25% of 12th grade females admitted to binge drinking. 70% of ninth graders and 27% of 12th graders admitted to using marijuana. 4% of ninth graders and 5% of 12th graders admitted using meth at least once per year. In 2000, the Council on Crime and Justice found that few juvenile justice jurisdictions provide appropriate juvenile treatment services. They also found that less than 40% of public and private detention, correctional, and shelter facilities provide treatment. Existing treatment is limited to support groups and with gaps in comprehensive assessment and individualized treatment, and that it is difficult to obtain treatment for co-occurring addictive and mental health disorders. Well, the task force was equally concerned with issues related to DWI and alcohol abuse. In Minnesota's alcohol use is higher than the national average. Over 33,000 DWI arrests occur each year. 40% are repeat offenders. About 1 in 9 drivers have a DWI on their record. 65% of alcohol-related fatalities involve first-time offenders. So what can be done? Some jurisdictions in Minnesota have begun to address these problems through the establishment of problem-solving approaches such as drug courts. A drug court uses the coercive power of the court in collaboration with other stakeholders, prosecutors, defense, treatment providers, probation, law enforcement, and the like. To closely monitor the defendant's progress toward sobriety and recovery through ongoing treatment, frequent drug testing, regular mandatory check-ins before the court, and the use of a range of intermediate sanctions and incentives to foster behavioral change. Now, in the last several years, a number of drug courts have been created using federal or state startup monies. Currently in Minnesota, we have 18 drug courts operating in 14 counties, and there are 10 additional drug courts that are in planning. And in your materials is a map of where these are located. So after months of study, what are the conclusions reached by the task force? And let me begin by saying what the task force is not recommending. It does not propose the effective decriminalization of alcohol and other drug offenses, or that all such offenses should be diverted. It's not recommending that violent offenders be involved in problem-solving courts. And the task force does not recommend modification of the state's aggressive DWI offender prosecution. What the task force does recommend, however, is a broad and fundamental shift, a paradigm shift in the judicial branch dealing with AOD offenders, including greater collaboration among the criminal and juvenile justice system participants, but with a focus on holding the offender accountable for his or her conduct and recovery, with swift and certain interventions and sanctions as needed to support behavioral change. The task force also calls for a comprehensive, multi-phase plan to institute these changes statewide. The multi-year plan would set out an implementation schedule and address strategies for the sustainability and funding of drug courts. The plan will be developed under the auspices of a state-level team, calling on membership from the current task force. And judicial leadership will be designated to lead local collaborative efforts to implement these drug strategies. It's anticipated that the implementation of drug courts and problem-solving strategies will improve outcomes for AOD offenders by enhancing their chances for long-term sobriety and recovery, thereby reducing recidivism. For example, a recent study in the state of New York shows that recidivism rates decreased 29% over 3 years for participants in drug courts. Second is a reduction in criminal justice costs at the state and local level through a reduction in incarceration. costs as well as enhanced social functioning for these AOD offenders. In California, $14 million was invested in drug courts, which created a cost avoidance of over $43 million over a two-year period. A total of something like 425,000 jail days were avoided, with a net cost savings of about $26 million. And finally, we expect greater consistency in the availability of problem-solving approaches for these offenders, so that equal treatment, some would say equal justice, is afforded to these offenders regardless of where they might happen to live. Now, the task force contemplates a multi-phased approach to the development of drug courts and problem-solving strategies around the state. This year's request we view as foundational, as seed money, to lay the groundwork for what we anticipate would be a larger package in the regular biennial budget to expand drug courts to greater, more parts of the state. This phase one recommendation includes a request for $750,000 for regional multidisciplinary training, a study of existing funding streams for AOD services, and an appropriation to fill some critical gaps. Key to the paradigm shift that the task force advocates is the need to institutionalize collaborative relationships at all levels. Through our experience with the Children's Justice Initiative, we know that the best way and most effective way to get collaboration is through the creation of multidisciplinary teams. So these team members would include judges and court personnel and prosecutors, defense counsel, probation, treatment, social services, law enforcement, and others in the local community. Team members will be brought together for county and regional training. This training will provide education on problem-solving techniques and best practices. It will provide an opportunity for all stakeholders to share their experiences, and it will foster this paradigm shift to a team approach in what was really is a very otherwise very adversarial kind of a setting. Now, a significant obstacle to broader development of drug courts is the uncoordinated funding of AOD services. Different funding streams and systems support the various stakeholders in the drug court arena, AOD arena, and this results in a funding structure that is overly complex, fragmented, and inefficient. The system is further compounded by poor coordination and communication between the different systems. For example, although there's a substantial amount of federal, state, and local money provided for treatment and other costs related to drug courts, it was done in silos. And the complexity and lack of coordination creates obstacles for getting needed treatment in a timely way. And no one really has the comprehensive understanding of where all of the funding and other costs related to drug courts and treatment comes from or how it's spent. And so the second component of this request then is for $300,000 to commission a study of the current funding streams with the goal of identifying and analyzing how the different entities, programs, and services are currently funded and how funding might be structured differently to remove these problems and maximize efficiencies. Now, we are also requesting $200,000 to implement a pilot multi-county problem-solving effort. As you know, we have 10 judicial districts. 8 of them have multiple counties in them. And in these judicial districts, there are many counties that are what we would say are relatively low-volume courts. And so we have recognized the need from a cost feasibility standpoint to develop problem-solving approaches that can be implemented across county lines. Now, judges can and do travel between the counties, and a single drug court coordinator can run a program in multiple counties, but the challenge really is working with up to three different correctional delivery service systems, as well as multiple county attorneys, social service agencies, and treatment providers, and different funders all at the same time. So the experience of this pilot will show us how to do that and should help us replicate this model in other parts of the state. And there are many other low-volume counties that could benefit by this and make delivery of services in those counties cost-effective. And finally, accessibility, as we've heard earlier today, to a variety of treatment services is an essential component. It's an essential component in our judicial problem-solving approaches. And in many jurisdictions, adequate treatment services are not available, in large part because of the lack of funding. This part of our request would be used to fill some treatment gaps in currently operating drug courts. An example of this would be a cognitive behavioral treatment services, for example, in Hennepin. So in conclusion then, we know the problem. It's the challenge of the increasing number of AOD persons in the criminal justice system. The work of the task force and its recommendations present the future opportunity of administering justice for more effective results. Results that will increase public safety, reduce criminal justice costs, save taxpayers dollars, and improve life outcomes for offenders. So on behalf of the task force and the judicial branch, I would urge your support of this as a first step in that road.
Thank you, Ms. Bissell. Any other comments, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, no, unless there are questions.
Okay.
It's my intent to ask you to lay this bill over, and at the time we put an omnibus bill together to consider funding, if there is available funds, the $750,000 requested for this effort.
Okay, we have a couple questions. Representative Paymar, and then Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Saul, earlier on in your presentation, you had a slide up that said that in 1990, drug offenders occupied 9% of prison bed space, and in 2003, they occupied 25%. Now, are those in our county jails, or is that a state DOC institution?
That would be DOC institutions, as I understand.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Sal, this 25%, which has alarmed, I think, members of this committee, the growing incarceration rate of drug offenders, do you offhand know if these are dealers? Are they individuals who have multiple arrests for possession, or do we not have the answer to that?
I'm asking my counsel, and yeah, we don't know. But this is something that I'm sure that we could work with DOC to get you some more information on.
I mean, I guess I'm just wondering, and I don't know if any of this money could be used for that, but there's several of us on this committee in a bipartisan manner. We're looking last year at some way to some sort of, I don't know if diversion program is the right word, but some way of incarcerating drug offenders in a less secure institution where it would be more focused on chemical dependency treatment rather than incarcerating those offenders with drug and alcohol problems in our DOC institution. So it's not a lot of money, but I'm wondering if any of that could be funneled in that direction. So, yeah, I guess that's the question.
Well, I think the thinking of this task force, which you understand is representative of DOC and public safety and state and local, the thought is that this is where we would be headed, hopefully, that we would be able to shift from the back end some of these funds to the front end and save money as we do it. But, of course, there's the startup costs that are needed here. And in terms of the imprisonment rate, I guess the data at least says that that certainly does not have success rates when that's all there is but incarceration.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to follow up. So I'm just wondering, of the $750,000 for these local and regional teams, I mean, what could that be? One goal of one of the teams would be to figure out a meaningful diversion program for drug offenders, so they're not ending up in our
prisons,
in our statewide prisons. I mean,
well, that is obviously the group of cases that we're looking at, and that is a potential sanction for a drug court defendant who does not comply with her probationary conditions. One sanction is to send them to prison, and that you're trying to keep them out of prisons through this regimen of problem-solving strategies. But that certainly is the intent, and that certainly is the category of people that drug courts would look at.
Mr. Wilson, wouldn't it be fair to say that a drug court, in one sense, is a diversion program?
Representative Eastland, I think that they try not to say that this is a diversion program, and in fact, it's a much more intensive program within the court, and that's what makes the difference. And I'm looking at Representative Murphy, who's attended and participated in a drug court experience in Duluth, that there's much more court intervention and monitoring than in the normal kinds of cases. But clearly they're trying, it's diversion from prison, they're trying to keep them in the community and provide the array of services individualized to each defendant based on their unique set of circumstances, and bring them along and support their recovery and hopefully bring them back to law-abiding life.
To this point,
Mr. Chair, yeah. Participated as an observer.
Yes. I can attest to that. I was an observer also at the same day.
Okay, Representative Ellison.
Well, Mr. Chair, I actually have participated in drug court as a lawyer, and I don't have any questions to ask. I just want to say, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, that I think this is the right way to go. I'm very pleased that you're doing this, and I'm going to support it. I think that in the long term, we will find that investing in treatment is going to save us money. It's going to salvage people who can be contributing members of our society, and I think this is the way to go, and I'm glad you're doing it, and I support it. Let me also say that a drug court is not diversion. Drug court can include diversion, but it's not diversion. People who are selling large volumes of drugs go to prison from drug court. Okay, so that makes it not diversion. You are subject to going to prison from drug court, although if you're a first-degree seller, you may make your court appearances through drug court, but you're not necessarily going to end up in diversion. But if you have a low amount, there often is diversion components with it, but those are the fifth-degree controlled substances, maybe sometimes the third-degree controlled substance people, but not the first and the second level dealers. And also, the one good thing about it is that people, in the old way of doing this, you pick up your drug case, you're out, you get caught selling or taking drugs, and you're charged with an offense, and even in the most expeditious county, you're going to wait about 4 weeks before you're going to have, between when you get arrested and then you get your first appearance, you see a judge, you're probably going to be released because it's not a violent offense, and then you got 4 to maybe 6 weeks before you see anybody again. And then, what are you doing in the meantime? You're using drugs. That's what you're doing, because you're addicted. It's not rational. It's an addiction. You're compelled to do this. And then, after your pretrial, what are you going to do with the next 6 weeks before your trial? You're going to use drugs. So you're using drugs the whole time that your case is pending. Maybe you get busted again. The beauty of drug court is you get arrested, you're going to get a Rule 25 drug assessment right away. After that, you got to come in on a regular basis and see the judge for what they call reviews. So you don't have these long expanses of time to go get in trouble. you're dropping UAs on a regular basis, you're coming in front of the judge on a regular basis, and your case is being dealt with in an expeditious way, and your treatment needs are being addressed. For people who are putting, who are using this as a way to make money, you know, they are going to have a more a serious consequence, but they don't lose their due process rights, which is another beautiful thing about drug court. You know, this is still America. We still have a Sixth Amendment to the Constitution. People still have a right to do, to contest their search and all that, and they should have it, and that exists within the drug court context. So, you know, I think drug court's a good idea, and I'm glad we're looking at spending more money to investigate how to deal with drugs more as a medical problem than as a criminal justice problem.
Representative Sorensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to know if you looked at the New York, you know, you quoted New York, but I ordered or got from them a huge sack of information. And they do have, they have long-term treatment centers, and they send people immediately, if they'll plead guilty, I think it is, to a long-term treatment center for 18 months, and then, and so that they're getting, we don't have those available in Minnesota, the long-term treatment center. So I think that that's one of the problems that I can see is we don't have treatment centers that are long-term. And the other thing is that we don't have jail programs, and it frustrates me that people that I know are sitting in jail for 6 months, and there would be an opportunity to talk to them about meth and the problems and anger management and parenting and all these things instead of just sitting there. And I really feel that we're wasting that time when they're there. And I've talked about that, and nothing has happened this far. But we could start right there with some jail programs that would start this process. And then I have always felt that when somebody goes into jail, there should be a counselor there. There should be somebody that would say, you know, why did you get here? Is there anything that we could do to get you off because you've got their attention and they're sitting there? But the reality is that no one talks to them. The only people they talk to would be their public defender briefly when they're going to appear. And when they do an assessment, I always thought they sat down and talked to the person about their life. An assessment means that somebody looks at their records and makes a decision and doesn't really even talk to the person that's sitting in jail. So that's an assessment. I thought when they used to talk about I'm going to get an assessment that somebody was sitting down with them and talking about the direction their life was going, but they don't. And then I guess we're talking about all these people. I would be very interested to bring 20 people in here that have gone through the system and let them talk for 5 minutes and say to this committee, you know, what do they think about our system? I mean, we're always talking about these people, but we never, ever hear from them. And I would think it would be very interesting to hear what they have to say. Thank you.
I have one question I'd just like to, if you could respond to, Ms. Vassell. In New York, I think it's slide 15 here, you talked about some of the 29% decrease in recidivism and that sort of thing. We've got a number of drug courts in Minnesota already that are functioning and many that are being planned. Do we have any data from Minnesota experience that tells us if what we're doing here, at least on the front end, is showing that kind of promise?
Mr. Chair, the drug courts that we have in Minnesota are almost all relatively new. Hennepin County is the only exception to that. And as you know, you need a longer beginning to go through. Usually there's a year period to get through to finish the program, and then you're looking for recidivism rates after that. So you're talking about, you know, probably 3 years or 4 years out before you get a good handle on that. So we are replicating the strategies and the protocols of the successful drug courts that have been evaluated, evaluated by outside objective evaluators of these programs. So we think that this is something that we're, you know, we're moving along on here in Minnesota, but we just don't have the data here. But I can just tell you this task force seems to have this real belief that this is long overdue, that this change in this philosophy and handling it just makes sense about the you know, Representative Ellison talked about the fact that, you know, the timeliness is so important. You know, the justice delayed is justice denied, and the one thing that we know about recidivism, I guess, that's been objectively shown, has the strongest impact on recidivism is the swiftness between the incident and the time of a judicial sanction. And that's so much of what this is. So we don't have all the data, but we are committing to do an evaluation. In fact, we have an evaluation of the Wilder Foundation underway in these drug courts. And so we will be able to come back with you and share this, whatever we might have. I'm not sure if we yet have enough data for next year when we would come back, but we certainly will talk about that. And we're absolutely committed to doing things that work. If they don't work, we don't want to be doing them.
Okay, seeing no other questions,
Mr. Chairman, could I summarize for your benefit and also that of the record? I do appreciate the sporting comments of everyone here, Representative Ellison, especially yours as well. This is two things, Mr. Chairman. This is labeled on the agenda. Whoever prepared that will discuss it later, but it's just kidding. It's labeled as seed money. The problem with seeds is you've got to water them. So, I mean, we'll be seeing this again. So we need to remember that. This is the right approach to go, and I think we should remember, and it is my intent in carrying this bill, that we do go forward with all the good things that we've heard here, with the recognition that contained in the own recommendation of this task force, that it is not a broad statement of an intent to do some things. It is not an intent to decriminalize alcohol or drug offenses. It is not the intent to include all automatic, if you will, diversion of alcohol or other drug offenses. And it is not the intent here to include violent offenders in AOD the way they will be handled. What is recommended is, and I will summarize, at least my intent, what is recommended is that we look at and recognize the judiciary as a separate and co-equal branch and trust they will come up with some new and innovative ways as they operate the drug courts within the suggested parameters of the task force evaluation. So with those qualifications, if you will, those things that are not recommended and those things that are, I think we should, when we get to it and have the money, I think we should spend this money, and I think we will be spending more later on. So having said that, I would appreciate you laying it on the table and we take a look at it later.
Thank you, Representative Smith, and thank you, Ms. Dozel, and with that we will, Chair will lay House File 2953 on the table for future consideration. The next bill we are considering today is House File 3198, anti-meth education programs for schools by Crime Stoppers, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of opening remarks. We may have up to three witnesses. I think they're well qualified to take about 30 minutes maximum of your time, all three combined, and present to you some information. And what I'd like to summarize, and I will then get off this chair, gentlemen, so you can share the microphone. Mr. Chairman, at this time also, I would like to move the bill and that it be laid on the table for discussion at a later in session. Last year, this committee undertook sweeping legislation to combat the scourge of meth in the state of Minnesota. We've had some real successes in our House File 1 from last year. The number of labs seized has been cut by about 70% because cookers no longer have easy access to the key ingredient, pseudoephedrine. County and local governments have begun to benefit from the cleanup fund. Prosecutors are using the new offenses to crack down on meth cookers and distributors. This year, we will be looking to find resources for other parts of the fight against meth. At other times, you may hear funding requests for drug courts, chemical dependency treatment, undercover efforts, and so forth to battle meth imported from other states or Mexico. But one area where we did not have money last year was in anti-meth education. This bill before you is an effort to fill that gap. If we can educate children before they get involved in meth, we can save hundreds or more lives. To help in this effort, Senator Ranum in the Senate and I looked for an organization that has a proven record in anti-crime efforts in education. And today I'd like you to hear from one, that one, a Crime Stoppers organization, Dr. Gary Thurrod. And gentlemen, if you could take about 1.5 hour to combine it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Smith. Welcome to our committee. We have Dr. Thurrod, Mr. Bright, and Mr. Mehta, is that correct? Okay, would you, as you want to testify, would you identify yourself and for the record and then proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, other representatives sitting at the table. My name is Gary Thurrod. I am the Executive Director for Crime Stoppers Incorporated. Crime Stoppers, Inc., I'm sure many of you have heard of us. You've seen us on television, our name. We're the second oldest Crime Stoppers in the world, and there are now 1,300 of them. Crime Stoppers International was just granted United Nations observer status, and it's expanding dramatically around the world. Here in Minnesota, we are developing a number of cities with Crime Stopper organizations. We are very unique in that we have the ability to cross boundaries. We work with the media, with the police departments, with organizations, with churches, with government, federal, district, state, local. We work with the DEA, FBI, anybody that's involved in solving crime, because so many of our citizens don't want to deal with the police, so they call Crime Stoppers as their alternative. We guarantee anonymity, and within our program, we contact the appropriate office and work with them to solve the crime. Now, a few years ago, before I started as executive director, Crime Stoppers determined that we needed to be involved with the youth in our schools because a lot of crime was going on, a lot of drug abuse within the school system. And our founders, Stanley Hubbard of KSTP and Minneapolis and St. Paul Police Departments, were the founders of Crime Stoppers. They felt that this was an important move for us. And Crime Stoppers took a program from Wisconsin called the Quick 50 program, brought it to the Bloomington school system, and asked the Bloomington school system, could they take a look at this program and how would it be incorporated into Bloomington and other school systems throughout Minnesota? The students themselves changed the name. They didn't like Quick 50 represented, rather than get a big reward, you could get $50 as a reward for a tip that led to solving a particular crime in a school. So they changed it to Youth Against Crime. And that program became part of the five core value system of the Bloomington school system. Unfortunately, one of our board members, the assistant superintendent of schools, Dr. Janet Platson, could not be here at this time. She had a conflict. She could have been here with us this morning if we had been able to be involved with you at that time. Part of what we do is creative, innovative, because what we deal with is a side of society that fears dealing with the regular system. Our process of involvement in the community is to utilize volunteers. We're unique in that we cross those boundaries by involving volunteers who are police, who are the media, who are within organizations or within the churches, individuals that say we want to make a difference on crime within our community, and we view Crime Stoppers as a very unique alternative. The Youth Against Crime program now has been tested in the Bloomington school systems for almost 3 years, and now we're going to roll it out to other school systems across the state. This particular program requires funding, and that's why Crime Stoppers has come to the state to seek assistance. We are a volunteer 501c3 nonprofit organization that does not receive funding from the state or any other federal or government agency. All of our funding comes from private donations, foundations, organizations, churches. If you look on our website, you'll see a number of cases that are going on in your community. The church cross burning incident recently, they came to us and they said, we'd like to offer a reward and can you help us? We had a case last week where an individual called, didn't want to deal with the police, but she said a man had just told her he'd killed somebody. And he was involved with drugs and he was high on meth at the time he did it. We called, and he was getting ready to leave town. We called the police. Police got involved. They said this man was totally off the radar, but the last week got his vehicle, and his vehicle had all the evidence. They arrested him, and he confessed. Our tips have led to meth labs in different parts of the city, St. Paul, Minneapolis, suburban areas. We've gotten tips as far away as Florida and Washington and Maine and Oregon of individuals dealing with drugs that are coming here into the Twin Cities, and they want us to know. Oftentimes we're involved with the DEA because they happen to be major programs. So we have the ability to cross these boundaries. And we operate nonprofit organizations. While we are very service-oriented, we have to be a business. We have to be responsible to our constituents, to our citizens. We need more opportunities for service, and this bill will provide us that opportunity. Because as the newspaper headlines recently said on a handout we just gave you, the meth shared toll is growing, and crime is on the rise, and more of the criminals are resorting to meth as a vehicle to support their crime. And so by supporting this particular measure, we believe we're going to have an impact through the youth, through the organizations, through the media across Minnesota that normally other organizations would not have. I'd now like to, we're not going to take up your half hour, but I'd like to turn to the chairman of our board is Mr. Randy Bright. Mr. Randy Bright's been involved in security for many years, University of Minnesota and Northwestern Hospital System. Mr. Chairman Randy Bright.
Thank you, Mr. Thorwood. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Bright, would you state your name for the record and proceed with your comments?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. My name is Randy Bright. I currently serve as the Operations Director for Security Services, University of Minnesota Medical Center, Fairview. I've been in the security industry for about 20 years. I've also had the opportunity to be a ChemDep counselor, a behavioral therapist for a number of years and prior experiences. Fairview, many of you do not know, is our largest treatment facility for behavioral cases, mental health, ChemDep, in the state. So I see it on both ends of enforcement as well as the end results and the cost in our community and health care costs. A lot of good stats I heard today in presentations before you, before we were able to present, that talked about the impact that's going on in our community. I've seen it. I live it. We've seen the success through the Bloomington schools when we were invited in. Yes, there were a lot of problems with crime, but it wasn't necessarily the act of crime. It was the loss of values that we were more focused on, trying to help kids understand rights and wrongs, giving them alternative means of choice, helping them with those choices through guidance, through education, through support. That's been very successful. We have stopped guns. We have stopped drugs. We have stopped lives being lost recklessly through these education programs. Communication has always been a struggle in all our societies for generations. I think that, again, seeing the results through the courts, the cost of incarceration, I absolutely believe in prevention. You know, that ounce of prevention pays huge down the line. We've got to give these young folks, our future, alternative ways. We've got to send very strong messages. Yes, incarceration is one of them, but that's down the path. We've got to stop it before it gets there. So I think if we're able to engage people in helping them understand the destructiveness, the costs, the alternatives that are out there, that we're going to be much farther ahead. I also work as a drug diversion investigator for our organization, and I'm part of NADI, the National Association of Drug Diversion Investigators. And I look at recent statistics that are presented from federal government research programs where we are still seeing, you know, 21, just numbers here quickly, 21% of 8th graders using illicit drugs, 38% 10th graders, 50% 12th graders. It's going up as you get older. They're getting comfortable with that outlet. When you look at kids today, where are they going? They're going to the stores. What are they getting? Powerade, no longer. They want AMP. They want that amphetamine kind of rush. And we've got to give them a new rush. We've got to give them new outlets. We collaborate with churches. We collaborate with the Minnesota Twins as one of our partners. KSTP is another good group that's helped us carry our message out. But as Dr. Thurwood really expressed, as a nonprofit, we struggle like every other nonprofit in this community to try and be of service to the community. But funding is tight. And we've seen success with our program in Bloomington. We know this will succeed as we move forward throughout the state. We need your support. We need your help for us to help you, to help our communities. Again, I think the proof is in the pudding. You look at our stats over the years, we're a proven entity for resources to law enforcement. We've gotten their trust. They know that we give them the data and help them get the information they need to do the things we need to take these issues off the plate. So I would express great desire and hope that you will embrace this thought, this opportunity for our partnership together, for us to continue to make an impact in our communities in a very positive way.
Thank you, Mr. Bright. Mr. Mehta,
thank you.
Would you like to state your name for the record and proceed with your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Thomas Mehta. I'm the Vice Chair of Crime Stoppers. I'm here for a softer approach in talking about meth and the children. Above and beyond my position for Crime Stoppers, I'm a husband, a father of a six-year-old girl who's in first grade, a 14-year-old son who's in high school. I've been in security management for 25 years. I'm the director of safety and security for Metropolitan State University. So I have some experience in terms of crime and where our children are today and what I hear about my children's friends. As a husband, a father, a state safety worker, I recognize the crucial decision that each of you are faced with today in determining where our state's financial resources are going. I further recognize that there's social and moral struggles in our society that we're faced with in the area of controlling meth and drug abuse. We've heard from a variety of individuals where we're at as a society and where we've gone thus far in trying to control those efforts. I have listened to my son's story about other children in the school that have not heard the message of drug abuse. It's amazing listening to a freshman in high school, and I have a good kid. He's a straight-A student, and he's on the basketball team, and so I have to believe that my message to him is struck home. But there are kids in high school right now who are listening to pushers because they don't hear the message from anyone else. I believe that you have the ability today to offer assistance in this area by supporting Crime Stoppers, an organization who has a proven track record within high schools right now. We're established in high schools. We're established with, with law enforcement agencies. With the proper funding, our existing program could be expanded to reach a greater percentage of these kids in high schools. I believe this is where we need to catch them before they're a part of the legal system and the recidivism is off the wall. It's our social obligation to reach these children before the drug pushers do, before they become faceless victims and lose their direction in an environment that's designed to expand their horizons. The future of our children, whether in first grade or ninth grade, depends upon our actions to support this effort. So please help us with funding and support these efforts so we can better educate the children who do not have the strength to say no and who desperately need to hear that message. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mehta. Thank you, presenters. Are there any questions from the committee of these presenters, Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, is this going to grow into the new DARE program?
Representative Smith?
Madam. Representative Murphy, I it's a good question. I don't know the answer. I don't think so. I saw a head shaking no from one of the testifiers. Would you like his thought on it? Do you want it to?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know. I know that some schools have stopped the DARE program for a variety of reasons, but it boils down to financial. And I think one of the reasons the cost of the program or bringing the police officer in or whatever is it, and they say they can't afford it anymore, and so if they're not able to finance that program, how are they going to be able to finance the Crime Stopper program when our grant funding decreases? Or is it, this is another seed where this will grow and grow and grow?
There is no...
What do you envision
this? Dr. Thoreau, do you want to comment to that?
Surely. There is no cost to the school for the Youth Against Crime program. Crime Stoppers develops an award system for that particular school. We work with the student councils. We work with the local police representatives. We work with the staff of the schools. But there is no cost to the school for the program.
Representative Murphy?
And, Mr. Chair, will this, do you know, will this be program, if the school adopts this program, will this be eligible for that portion of the property tax dollar? I think it's 80 cents per pupil for drug and education kind of thing.
Representative Smith, you want to trade that one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I don't know the answer. If staff knows, they can answer it, but it's a question asked and we should find the answer. I don't know.
Do we have any staff that would like to comment on that, Mr. Carter? So we don't know the answer. It's information we can get.
Dr. Thoreau, do you know?
No, ma'am. As a matter of fact, that's never been raised before. And I didn't know that that was an alternative. I do know that the purpose of Youth Against Crime and Crime Stoppers is not to replace any other organization, because so many organizations have good quality programs that they run. Crime Stoppers is not just about the meth program. We are also individuals on the front line of fighting crime in the community, and crime and, of course, meth and drugs go hand in hand. We're also, as acknowledged by the United Nations, on the front line defense against a variety of terroristic activities in the United States. One Crime Stoppers broke up an Al-Qaeda cell recently. So our function is not just as a DARE would be. Our function is broad-based, but yet in fighting crime, now drugs has become such a volatile issue in the community that we must, through this program, address that, and this is one of the vehicles to do that and combine the other resources we have.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Farrow, how does this program work with the police liaison officer program?
Dr. Thoreau?
We coordinate with them on a regular basis, and when oftentimes if things get a little busy, they call us. At one of the Bloomington schools last year, one young man financed his prom through tips about drugs. And the police officer said he was rather concerned that this was going on. We work with police liaison. We also work with crime prevention agencies within different communities. And right now, for instance, I'm working with the police in Granite Falls to establish not only a Crime Stoppers, but they want a Youth Against Crime in the Granite Falls school system. And so we have our contacts and volunteers around the state that are going to be get involved in that area.
We have other Crime Stoppers throughout Minnesota that are going to be involved in this program as well. Within the school system, there are no costs for the development of the Youth Against Crime program. So what we do, as I indicated initially when we first began our discussions, that our volunteer base is probably what makes us so strong. People that are committed to the vision of Crime Stoppers, that are able to come forward and spend time working with us. That includes the police. While in many cities across America, as I discussed with Senator Ranum, many cities across America, the court fine system, a percentage of those court fines come to the local Crime Stoppers. In many cities across America, Crime Stoppers are physically located within the judicial headquarters of that local community. Here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, we prefer to be an independent. We have one of our board members with Hannon Security who is here that gives us free office space, for instance. So whenever we can, this is how we utilize the involvement of those people who care about what we do.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Maida had a comment. Do you want to comment to that point?
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I just wanted to speak with regards to the police liaison. While I believe that's an effective program in many of our high schools, unfortunately, and I'm not in a position to say whether this is right or wrong, many students don't have the comfort level to go to those individuals. So this program allows them another avenue to bring forward information that we can use, that the school system can use, to help offer some support and correct the environment.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Thurwood, do we have a budget plan or to tell us what our $199,475 is buying?
Yes, ma'am. I have several copies with me, and additional copies certainly can be provided for each committee member, which spells out in great detail each budget line item.
Representative Murphy?
I yield to Representative Paymar.
I don't know if we'll do that committee, but Representative Paymar.
I just have two questions. Can you share with us how you've measured success in the Bloomington School District?
One of the key areas is the student response. Again, when you talk about the officer liaison, we saw barriers there of people willingness to talk with them, hesitancy to be involved with law enforcement, to where we found more and more people feeling comfortable with the approach and seeing by offering information that those walls came down, those relationships began to build. Another one, of course, is the end result of looking at how many, you know, weapons, drug cases have been resolved through the different schools. So much so that the focus stopped going at the high schools because the number originally was very high to now it's a very low level, weekly, maybe every other week kind of call, where we were getting them three or four a day at the same site, to now being asked to be looking at middle schools, grade schools, because they're seeing that they're getting programs in place, behaviors being stopped now by our program at the high school level, but they need to stop it before the kids get into the high school level. So it seems to me that, again, you know, we've paid out a lot of rewards in schools, but over the years, the amount we pay out to these schools now has dramatically dwindled. But the ask is, now can we shift that money into middle schools, into grade schools?
Well, Mr. Chair, as I read the grant, or I read the bill, this money, anyone could apply for this money. Is that correct? It's not dedicated to the Crime Stoppers, Inc.
Representative Smith, I think you want to...
Or are you planning on... I mean, sounds like they've already got a budget and got the money spent, but if they get it, but it doesn't say in the bill, it sounds like anyone could apply to DPS for the money.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pamer, a strict constructionist reading of this bill would lead one to that conclusion.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pamer, that was a bit rude. It is maybe faultily drafted. This bill is aimed at this particular group, but not necessarily limited in the long run of our meanderings.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, gentlemen, to any one of the three presenters, Representative Murphy danced all around my question but never really asked it, and I will tell you parenthetically, I'd be very interested in seeing the budget that you prepared if you could make arrangements to get it to the committee so we could look at it at some time in the future. To the point that Crime Stoppers Inc. is a 501(c). And I've heard you describe, I think it's Dr. Thoreau described it, there's a lot of volunteers that are involved in this. Could any one of the three of you address issues such as the underlying organization of your corporation? Do you have full-time employees? Do you have part-time employees? What percentage of your budget goes to administrative costs such as employees, et cetera? I'm curious that, you know, if we give you $200,000, are you going to spend 90% of it on the CEO of the corporation? Those kinds of issues.
That's a very good question. We have an exceptional staff of one, and that is me. And I'm the only individual that's paid by the organization. Everything else is done on a volunteer basis, and no part of this budget includes my salary. And I think that's critical. We're not paying people within this budget. That's not the purpose. We want the budget to be completely impacting the purpose of the organization. And we raise money from donors, we golf tournaments and things like that to pay the salary. The office is donated. The phone system is donated. So I'd like to have staff. But we are now working out a program with Metropolitan State University, for instance, to have interns assisting us not only in the office on a regular basis, but if we are fortunate enough to receive this program, a number of the individuals involved in this program also doing the work within the office will be interns.
Thank you, Dr.
Representative Murphy, one more question.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair, Dr. Thoreau. So all your volunteers have background checks?
Well, I would say the majority of them, far and away. We have a board. It starts with our board of directors. Our board of directors are people like John Locks, chief of police, used to be the Minneapolis police chief, Tom Randy, Nick up there, Janet from the Bloomington school system, individuals with a deep dedication to the organization. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandy Keith is on our board of advisors, and we get advice from strong people within the community. Within the police department, be it Bloomington or Minnestrata or wherever it happens to be, and we need services in those particular areas, we can pick up the phone and call. We don't just take people off the street and involve them within the organization, especially within the school system. All of the individuals involved with our schools at the present time are the individuals primarily from our board of directors that are working throughout the schools. And as other school systems come to us, the superintendents, the assistant superintendents come to us and say, we would like this within our system. They become our liaison people. Janet, for instance, with the Bloomington schools, and that's why she ended up being recruited to serve on the board. You know, because we felt that we needed that vested educational interest from a security standpoint. You know, how can we best serve those kinds of issues? All of the people that get involved through them are also checked. Now, way down the line, is everybody checked? I would say no. Like any organization, they are not.
because somebody who gives just an hour of time, my wife who teaches the Minneapolis school system has a PhD in education, we didn't check her out, but you know, individuals, the wives or relatives of our friends of, that get involved with us are not necessarily checked.
But your general policy, Mr. Thorne, your general policy is to back check, Mr.
Yes.
Right, is shaking his head. Representative Murphy, one follow-up.
And the students that were, or the people that were going to be working with students in the schools would have background checks.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes,
absolutely.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
are you planning on taking this bill to Education Committee?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I hadn't planned on it. I planned to ask the chair to lay it on the table and keep it here. It seems we need additional information, but no, it's going to stay here unless there's a reason that develops.
One final comment, Mr. Mayor. Short, please.
I apologize if you don't have this in front of you, and this really outlines a lot of what's happening in this program. Well, I think one of my comments is that this program is existing right now to a much smaller level, and it's being very successful. If we had the funds to expand it to the next level, I sincerely believe, and I think you'll note that through the strategic proposal, that there will be a volume of success from high school to high school, from grade school to grade school. And it'll make a difference in several years down the line.
Okay, we'd like to thank the presenters here for Representative Murphy had one comment.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to think about this some more, and I do want to read the booklet. But Mr. Chair, remember when we had that hotline, or when we gave money to the Department of Public Safety for a hotline so people could turn people in, and we didn't have any good results, and the money just sat there, and so we took it back. Because people weren't turning people in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, collectively, I thought of that about 10 minutes ago, and maybe we should review that issue. That set of events, what we did and what happened there.
Right. And how this differs.
How this differs, that is correct. I see a bunch of nodding.
Yeah. Thank you for the presenters, and we will, Representative Murphy, your question, I think the staff understands the question about the tax, 80 cents per pupil, and we'll have that for you at the next meeting.
We'll get an answer by next meeting.
Okay, so with that, the meeting is adjourned.